Chapter 4. Geometry of Curved Spaces. Imagine a civilization of intelligent bugs living on a plane curve. These bugs have developed sophisticated mathematical techniques which go beyond the scope of this book. They also have access to precise measuring apparatus. Can they determine whether their one-dimensional universe is in fact a curve rather than a straight line? It turns out that they cannot. The curvature of a curve is an extrinsic property. It is visible to us because we view the curve as it sits in the plane. We can, however, delicately straighten the curve without changing its overall length or altering distances between the points. The bugs would just not notice. Now imagine another advanced civilization of bugs, but this time living on the surface of a sphere. It turns out that these bugs can, just by walking around and never leaving the surface, decide that their universe is curved. Curvature is an intrinsic property of the surface. This is far from obvious. The German mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss, who is widely regarded as one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, was very proud of this discovery, which he made in 1828. He called it the Theorema Egregium, which translates from Latin as remarkable theorem. In this chapter we shall, starting from the extrinsic curvature of curves, define Gaussian curvature and explain how it can be computed intrinsically. We shall also look at higher dimensional generalizations of surfaces called manifolds and introduce Riemannian geometry. Curved curves. We shall define the curvature of a curve on the Euclidean plane. Let this curve be a circle of radius r. In the absence of a formal definition, you will agree that the circle is curved in the same way at any of its points. Moreover, the larger the radius r, the less curved the circle. Circles of very large radius resemble straight lines, for which we would expect the curvature to vanish. We shall therefore define the curvature of a circle to be the reciprocal of its radius. K equals the fraction with the numerator 1 and the denominator r times. In the limit where r approaches infinity, we have k approaches zero, which is the curvature of a straight line. How about curves other than circles? Let us call the curve on figure 43, located in the print version of this book, gamma. The idea is to approximate gamma by circles with radii varying from point to point. For any point capital P on gamma, there are infinitely many circles which are tangent to gamma at capital P. We shall select one of these, called the osculating circle, which gives the best fit, and define the curvature of gamma at the point capital P to be the reciprocal of the radius of the osculating circle. To identify the osculating circle, note that near the point capital P, the curve divides the plane into two parts. Some of the circles tangent to gamma at capital P lie entirely on one side, and some lie entirely on the other. The osculating circle separates these two kinds of circles. On figure 43, it is drawn with a solid line. If you are familiar with calculus, you will reconcile this pictorial description with the fact that at the point capital P, the curve gamma has the same first and second derivatives as the osculating circle. This defines the osculating circle and its radius uniquely. If the curve is given as a graph of a function y equals the function of x, then its curvature is k equals the fraction with the numerator function double prime and the denominator open parenthesis 1 plus open parenthesis function prime close parenthesis squared close parenthesis to the power of 3 divided by 2, where function prime and function double prime are the first and second derivatives of function with respect to x. For example, the curvature of the parabola y equals x squared tends to zero, as x tends to infinity. This is in agreement with our intuition. Both tails of the parabola look approximately flat. The curvature is biggest at the origin, x equals 0, y equals 0, where it equals 2. The approach to geometry based on calculus is called differential geometry. While calculus is a powerful technique and is required to prove most assertions which will be made in this chapter, I have, in order to keep the discussion at an elementary level, chosen not to use calculus and to provide pictorial explanations instead. Listeners familiar with calculus should consult books listed in the bibliography. Curved surfaces. We shall use our definition of the curvature of a curve to define the curvature of a surface at any of its points. This surface, which I shall call uppercase sigma, is assumed to be smooth with no edges. Step 1. Slice the surface by a plane perpendicular to it at some point, capital P. Using the osculating circle, find the curvature of the slice curve, which is the intersection of uppercase sigma, with the plane. Step 2. Repeat the process by rotating the sliced plane while keeping it perpendicular to uppercase sigma at uppercase P. This gives the curvatures of the slice curves in all directions. We take these curvatures with a positive sign if the curve slices downwards, away from the plane at tangent capital P, and with a negative sign otherwise. Step 3. Let K sub max be the largest of the curvatures obtained in step 2, and let K sub min be the smallest. Define the Gaussian curvature of the surface to be capital K equals K sub min times K sub max. The Gaussian curvature of the sphere with unit radius is the same at any of its points, and equal to 1. All perpendicular planes intersect the sphere in circles of the same radius, so K sub min equals K sub max, and 1 and capital K equals 1 times 1 equals 1. The cylinder in figure 46b has zero Gaussian curvature, and is therefore called flat. The plane parallel to the axis intersects the cylinder in a straight line, and K sub min equals 0 for all points on the cylinder. Therefore, capital K equals 0 times 1 equals 0. The third surface in figure 46c, located in the print version of this book, has negative Gaussian curvature. The perpendicular planes shown in figure 46c intersect the surface at circles bending in opposite directions, so capital K is a product of a negative and a positive number. Points on uppercase sigma at which capital K is greater than 0 are called elliptic. If capital P is an elliptic point, then the tangent plane to capital sigma at capital P does not intersect the surface, at least in the small neighbourhood of the surface surrounding capital P. Points where capital K is less than 0 are called hyperbolic. The surface at such points resembles a horse saddle or a mountain pass, where the terrain rises in some directions and drops in others. As a hiker walks from hyperbolic point capital Q on the pass to an elliptic point capital P on the top of a mountain, the Gaussian curvature changes along the path from its negative value at capital Q to a positive value at capital P. If the path is sufficiently smooth, there will exist a point along it where the curvature is exactly 0. Near such a point, uppercase sigma looks like the surface of a cylinder. To make sense of Gaussian curvature, we used the extrinsic properties of the surface and looked at the way it sits embedded in the Euclidean space, the real set of numbers cubed. Gauss's theorema agregium states that capital K can be defined in a way intrinsic to the surface and can be measured at any point of uppercase sigma by a bug unaware of the surrounding three-dimensional space. One way this bug could do it is by picking a point capital P and constructing a circle with radius r about capital P. The notion of the distance d measured by the bug is intrinsic to the surface. For example, it would use the formula H1 if uppercase sigma were the Poincaré disk. For a general surface, the circle capital C centered at capital P is defined to be capital C equals, open bracket, all points capital Q on uppercase sigma such that D, open parenthesis, capital P, capital Q, close parenthesis, equals R, close bracket. The circumference of this circle would be 2 pi times R if uppercase sigma were the Euclidean plane. The presence of positive Gaussian curvature makes this circumference smaller, and negative Gaussian curvature makes it larger. According to the formula, circumference, capital C, equals 2 pi times r, minus capital K times pi, times the fraction with the numerator r cubed and the denominator 3, plus dot dot dot, where the dots denote terms containing powers of r greater than 3, which can be neglected for small circles. A typical surface, like that of a pear, is curved irregularly, and its Gaussian curvature varies from point to point. The plane, the sphere, and the Poincaré disk are special, as their Gaussian curvatures are the same at every point. On these three surfaces, any triangle satisfies alpha plus beta plus gamma equals pi plus capital K times the area of triangle capital A, capital B, capital C. Euclid's third and fourth axioms are satisfied if capital K is greater than or equal to zero, and the first four axioms hold if capital K is less than or equal to zero. The flat geometry of the plane, where Euclid's fifth axiom holds, arises as the limiting case of both hyperbolic and spherical geometry when capital K equals zero. The table, located in the print version of this book, summarizes the differences between the hyperbolic, spherical, and Euclidean geometries. To make these differences more transparent, I shall make the following definition. For any pair, capital P, iota, where iota is a line and capital P is a point not on iota, let us define capital N, open parenthesis, capital P, iota, close parenthesis, to be the number of lines through capital P which do not intersect iota. In Euclidean geometry, this number is equal to 1. This is one of the statements of Euclid's parallel axiom. The Gauss-Bonnet theorem. Gaussian curvature is a local quantity which can be computed at any point, capital P of uppercase sigma, using small circles, and it does not depend on how the surface looks away from capital P. There is, however, an amazing connection between Gaussian curvature and the global properties of the surface. To explain this, I shall first give another intrinsic description of capital K. Looking back at the spherical and hyperbolic geometry formulae S1 and H2, we see that, at least in these two cases, capital K equals the fraction with the numerator alpha plus beta plus gamma minus pi, and the denominator the area of triangle capital A, capital B, capital C, where triangle capital A, capital B, capital C is any triangle. A way to make sense of this formula for a surface where K changes from point to point is to consider delta times open parenthesis capital P close parenthesis to be a small triangle centered at capital P. Such a triangle is almost Euclidean, so its center can be defined as in Euclidean geometry. The Gaussian curvature at capital P then arises as a limiting case of the formula before, where the area of delta times open parenthesis capital P close parenthesis tends to zero and the sum of angles tends to pi. Let us assume that uppercase sigma is a surface with no edge, which can be completely enclosed by a sphere with arbitrarily large radius. Spheres and donut-shaped surfaces belong to this category, but a disk does not, as it is bounded by a circular edge. Imagine covering uppercase sigma with small, but not necessarily identical triangles in an arbitrary way. Each of these triangles can be used to compute capital K at their center. Let us do that, and multiply the resulting capital K by the area of the corresponding triangle. Now sum all these numbers. There are infinitely many of them, and they are infinitely small, because the areas are, so one needs to employ calculus and replace the sum by an integral. The Gauss-Bonnet theorem states that the integral of capital K over the whole surface when divided by 2 pi is related to the number of holes, G, also called the genus of the surface, by the formula the fraction with the numerator 1 and the denominator 2 pi, times the integral of uppercase sigma times capital K equals 2 minus 2g. If, for example, uppercase sigma is a sphere with radius 1, then capital K equals 1, and the integral gives the area of capital S squared equal to 4 pi. Dividing this by 2 pi gives 2, which agrees with the statement of the theorem, as the sphere has no holes, and its genus G equals 0. Not too surprising so far, but now imagine stretching and bending the sphere to form a pear-shaped surface. There will be regions where capital K is positive and regions where it is negative, but the total integrated curvature will balance out to give 4 pi. If uppercase sigma is a multi-holed donut, then capital K is positive close to the outside region and negative near the holes. The total curvature integrates to negative 8 pi, regardless of how the donut is bent. Although rooted in 19th century mathematics, the Gauss-Bonnet theorem is regarded as one of the deepest results in geometry, which has shaped a lot of the 20th and 21st century development in the subject. It connects local and global properties of surfaces and has been generalized to Riemannian manifolds, higher dimensional analogues of surfaces. We shall discuss those next. Manifolds. A manifold is a space which, in a small neighborhood of any of its points, looks like the Euclidean space. The dimension of this Euclidean space, the number of Cartesian coordinates needed to describe a point, is called the dimension of the manifold. Let us denote a manifold by the letter capital M, and let capital P be one of its points. The assignment of a Euclidean space to a neighborhood of capital P is called a map. A map allows us to employ methods of mathematical analysis like calculus, as long as we stay close to capital P. A difference between an n-dimensional manifold, capital M, and the space, the real set of numbers to the power of n, is that one map is usually not sufficient to cover the whole of capital M. We instead use a collection of maps called an atlas, which overlap in the way that maps in an ordinary road atlas do. For capital M to be a manifold, these overlapping regions on various maps must smoothly patch together in the way I shall now describe. Let us consider a two-dimensional sphere, which is an example of a two-dimensional manifold. Recall the Mercator map in figure 29. It distorts distances, but we are not worried about these at the moment. The problem with this map is that both the north and the south poles are not represented by points, but have been stretched to horizontal lines at the top and bottom edges of the map. This map is not a one-to-one projection of the sphere to the plane. We shall instead construct an atlas which consists of two maps. The first map will be constructed by Alice, who positions herself on the North Pole, capital N, and uses stereographic projection to map all the points of the sphere except capital N onto the plane. To do that, she joins any point capital P on the sphere to the North Pole by a straight line in the real set of numbers cubed. This line intersects the plane passing through the equator at some point, capital P prime, and this capital P prime is the image of capital P on Alice's map. Every point on capital S squared, apart from capital N, is mapped to some point on the plane in a one-to-one fashion. For example, the image of the South Pole is the origin of the plane, and the whole of the Antarctic is mapped onto a tiny region around this origin. On the other hand, the Arctic Circle is mapped to a huge region of infinite area. A region covered by a small coin close to the North Pole would appear far larger than the whole of Australia on Alice's map. If the equation of the sphere is x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals 1, and the coordinates of capital N are 0, 0, 1, then any point on the map constructed by Alice has coordinates u, v, where u equals the fraction with the numerator x and the denominator 1 minus z, and v equals the fraction with the numerator y and the denominator 1 minus z, which can be worked out using similar triangles. As Alice has excluded the North Pole, she does not have to worry about division by zero in these formulae, as the coordinate z is never equal to 1 away from capital N. As z gets closer to 1, the coordinates u, v become huge, resulting in the large Euclidean distance between the projected point and the origin of the plane. The second map is constructed by Bob, who stands on the South Pole, capital S, and stereographically projects the sphere onto the plane from capital S. The coordinates of a point on Bob's map are approximate u, approximate v, where approximate u equals the fraction with the numerator x and the denominator 1 plus z, and approximate v equals the fraction with the numerator y and the denominator 1 plus z. Alice and Bob would like to compare their maps. All points on the sphere, apart from capital N and capital S, have their unique images on each map. Using the defining equation of the sphere, Alice and Bob find the patching conditions. Approximate u equals the fraction with the numerator u and the denominator u squared plus v squared, and approximate v equals the fraction with the numerator v and the denominator u squared plus v squared. These expressions are well defined, as u and v cannot both be zero in the overlap region with capital N and capital S removed. From the point of view of mathematical analysis, the patching conditions are two functions from the real set of numbers squared to the real set of numbers squared which are smooth, meaning that they can be differentiated with respect to u and v. Manifolds resulting from patching relations with this property are also called smooth. The stereographic projection and the overlap patching conditions readily generalize to spheres of any dimension, so they are all manifolds with atlases consisting of two maps, and calculus can be employed. It turns out that aside from the stereographic projection, all choices of maps and patching relations lead to the same notion of calculus on the two-dimensional sphere. There is only one way in which it can be turned into a smooth manifold. Until the middle of the 20th century, this was generally believed to be the case for spheres of all dimensions. It thus came as a surprise when, in 1956, the American geometer John Milner showed that there are several non-equivalent atlases that one can introduce on the seven-dimensional sphere. The one coming from stereographic projection, and others now dubbed the exotic spheres. In the 1980s, it was shown that even the relatively familiar Euclidean space, the real set of numbers to the power of 4, can be turned into a smooth manifold in more than one, and in fact, infinitely many ways. Four dimensions appear to be special from the manifold theory perspective. One of the open problems in the field is to determine whether the four-dimensional sphere has any exotic structures apart from the one coming from the stereographic projection. According to Einstein's theory of gravitation, our universe is a four-dimensional manifold. We shall devote the whole of Chapter 7 to studying its properties. Riemannian geometry. While the notion of a distance function can be defined for general manifolds, it is a complicated object. An alternative was proposed by the German mathematician Bernhard Riemann in the Habilitation lecture he gave in 1854. Riemann, who was a student of Gauss, adopted an infinitesimal approach based on the idea that, in a sufficiently small region, geometry is nearly flat, and generalized the Gaussian curvature to manifolds of more than two dimensions. The following description avoids calculus, but requires some knowledge of matrices. Consider an infinitesimal displacement from a point capital P to a nearby point capital Q. This is given by a vector tangent to the manifold at the point capital P, represented by an arrow. The collection of all tangent vectors at capital P is the familiar space, the real set of numbers to the power of n, where n is the dimension of the manifold. A vector v in the real set of numbers to the power of n has n components, v1, v2, and so on, vn, and a length denoted by the absolute value of v with a square given by the absolute value of v squared equals open parenthesis v1 close parenthesis squared plus open parenthesis v2 close parenthesis squared plus dot 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 plus open parenthesis v sub n close parenthesis squared. In our case, each tangent space is equipped with its notion of length, given by an n by n symmetric matrix, which we shall call G sub capital P, to indicate its dependence on the point capital P. The squared length of a vector tangent at capital P is then given by V G sub capital P V to the power of capital T. If G sub capital P is the identity matrix, then this squared length equals the usual Euclidean one. A Riemannian metric is a collection of such n by n matrices, with one attached to each point, capital P, on the manifold, and varying smoothly with capital P. If capital P is close to capital Q, then the difference between the matrices, G at coordinates capital P and G at coordinates capital Q, is small. This metric is assumed to be positive definite in the sense that V of G sub capital P of V to the power of capital T is greater than or equal to zero, with equality only if all components of the vector V vanish. Given a Riemannian metric, the distance between any two points along a given curve can be computed by picking a large number of points along the curve and dividing the curve into segments. Each of these points is connected to a neighbouring point by a vector tangent to the curve. We now compute the length of each of these vectors using the Riemannian metric and add these lengths together. When the number of the segments tends to infinity, the length of each of the vectors tends to zero, but the sum of the lengths is a finite number, the length of the curve. To make this process rigorous and amenable to computations, calculus needs to be invoked, where summation is replaced by integration. The curved manifold does not need to be embedded in some higher dimensional flat space in order for all this to make sense, but it is easier to draw pictures if it is. However, it turns out that any Riemannian manifold can in fact be embedded in a Euclidean space of a sufficiently high dimension, in such a way that the Riemannian metric is induced by the Euclidean distance. This remarkable result was proven in 1966 by John Nash, the American mathematician who was later awarded a Nobel Prize in economics for his work on game theory. According to Nash's theorem, the maximal number of dimensions of the flat ambient space needed to embed an n-dimensional Riemannian manifold is half n times open parenthesis n plus 1 close parenthesis times open parenthesis 3n plus 11 close parenthesis. The Riemannian metric is a collection of n times open parenthesis n plus 1 close parenthesis divided by 2 numbers associated with each point of a manifold. The methods developed by Riemann use calculus to derive concepts like distance, area, and angles from the Riemannian metric. I shall now describe, without reverting to calculus, how one can make sense of the curvature of Riemannian manifolds. Having defined the length of the curve, we can attempt to pick the shortest curve, called the geodesic, connecting any two points, capital P and capital Q, on the manifold. At a first glance, this appears to be a formidable task. To make progress, one needs to take all possible curves between capital P and capital Q into consideration, compute the distances D, capital P, capital Q, along all these curves, and seek the optimal one, assuming that it even exists. Fortunately, there is a tool known as the calculus of variations, which does all that with relative ease as long as the Riemannian metric has been specified. This comes with a word of warning, as the shortest curve between two points does not have to exist at all. Consider, for example, a punctured Euclidean plane with the set of real numbers squared, where the origin, 0, 0, has been removed, and try to connect two points, capital P and capital Q, on the x-axis on the opposite sides of the puncture. Given any curve joining capital P and capital Q, a shorter curve may be constructed by zooming nearer to the puncture, but the limiting shortest curve does not exist. Geodesics do, however, exist locally, in a neighbourhood of any point on the manifold. So in the previous example, we can connect capital P with capital Q by a geodesic, which is just a straight line in this case, as long as capital Q is sufficiently close to capital P. The precise statement is that, given a point capital P on capital M and a direction vector at capital P, there exists a unique geodesic through capital P in this direction. Geodesics on the plane are straight lines. On the sphere, they are arcs of great circles, but in this case there can be more than one geodesic between two points. The north and the south poles are connected by infinitely many geodesics. Geodesics on the Poincaré disk are the hyperbolic lines discussed in Chapter 3. Two-dimensional Riemannian manifolds are just surfaces, and their Riemann curvature is the Gaussian curvature I explained earlier in the chapter. For higher-dimensional manifolds, the curvature at any point is no longer a single number, but instead an array of numbers assembled into what is called a tensor. To obtain these numbers, pick two independent directions in the tangent space to capital M at capital P. These directions span a plane, and the geodesics emanating in each direction on this plane lie, at least near the point capital P, on a two-dimensional surface, uppercase sigma. We compute the Gaussian curvature of uppercase sigma using the distance function resulting from restricting the Riemannian metric from capital M to uppercase sigma. This process is then repeated for all two-dimensional planes and the corresponding surfaces. For a general Riemannian manifold, the resulting Gaussian curvatures will be different and will depend on a choice of the plane. They are assembled into the Riemann curvature. For some manifolds, like the sphere, the curvature is positive and the same at every point, but for general manifolds it varies from point to point. The sign of the curvature has an effect on the behaviour of neighbouring geodesics. If the curvature is negative, then two close-by geodesics in parallel directions move away from each other. The positive curvature has the opposite, focusing effect. Imagine two meridians emanating from the equator in parallel directions, pointing out to the North Pole. They converge to each other, eventually meeting at the North and South Poles. This curvature effect has striking consequences, and underlies the Penrose-Hawking singularity theorems stating that the presence of mass leads to space-time singularities and black holes. We shall return to this point in Chapter 7.